It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The KGB, or the Комитет государственной безопасности, was the Soviet Union's security and foreign intelligence agency. It operated from 1954 to 1991. When the Soviet Union collapsed, it was replaced by the FSK and then the FSB in the new Russian Federation. Both have served similar security functions to the KGB. During its existence, unlike other country security agencies, the KGB was effectively an independent government body, with little oversight by Russian leaders. The organization performed a combination of duties, including intelligence gathering, border security, and propaganda enforcement. However, most controversially, it operated as Russia's secret police and domestic surveillance unit. More than 500,000 people were employed by the KGB, with thousands of international spies. At the time, it was the single largest institution of its kind. Around the world, the KGB gathered information by using legal resident spies, which were Soviet citizens given permission to be in other countries by way of working in embassies or similar international grounds. They would claim diplomatic immunity if they were caught. Russia also had illegal spies with no immunity, and although it was riskier, they were able to more easily integrate without immediate suspicion. Domestically, the KGB was feared as the country's secret police. They would seek out those suspected of being anti-communist or anti-government and frequently search their homes and arrest dissidents. They established individual departments for controlling religious activity, subversive nationalism, foreign influence, unauthorized media, and specifically the Jewish population.
Sandy Rios with you. That was a clip from Now This World. It's very hard to overstate the chill that went up our collective spines when we heard the term KGB. When I was growing up, that was, you just heard it described, at least to some extent, the danger, the infiltration, the power that they wielded. They had broadcasting that broadcast in languages all over the world, the propaganda of the Soviet Union, of the communist influence, which was bound and determined to conquer the world. I would say Nikita Khrushchev made that clear, I think, in 1959 in the United Nations when he took his shoe off and pounded the podium and said to us personally, the United States, we will bury you. When I was growing up, we had drills. We would hide below our desks because we thought there was going to be an imminent nuclear attack. The Cuban Missile Crisis was an outgrowth of that. All the tensions of those weeks when we thought there was going to be an attack from Russia on our shores, and they intended to, no question about it. It's hard to describe and recreate the dangers of the old Soviet Union and the communist regime and the communist mindset and ideology as it spread across the globe into China, into Korea, into Vietnam, and south of us, into South America, and on it goes. When the Soviet Union broke up, many people said, well, it's over. It's a new era. We started selling, all kinds of products to Russia, and we became very friendly. Thousands of Americans descended into Russia. And as a matter of fact, before the Soviet Union broke up, I did the first broadcast from Radio Moscow of any American ever. We did what we called 10 Days of Hope from the very top floor of the KGB building in Moscow. I remember interviewing the English language broadcaster, Yuri Minaev, about the attacks on churches. It was just an incredible time as we watched the Soviet Union unravel and what we thought was the unraveling of the mighty grip of the KGB at that time. But is it over? And did the Russians stop trying to overtake America? Many thought so. Many taught that. But we're going to talk about this a little bit today. And then, of course, fast forward to our news headlines about alleged Russian influence in the 2016 election. about the connection between the Russians and the Clintons, the Russians and President Obama, and the Russians and Donald Trump. And we want to talk about it with someone who knows a great deal about this. Let me just say that Diana West is an award-winning journalist. She's the author of two books, one called American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character, and The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. Diana has written so many books, won so many awards. She is a constant explainer, expounder of what's happening in the deepest, darkest parts of this world in what used to be the old Soviet communism model, but very much alive and well. She has been published in the Wall Street Journal, the Weekly Standard, the Atlantic Monthly, and on I could go. But I've asked her to join us this morning because she has most recently written a piece about this dossier on President Trump that was in part, at least, composed by a woman named Nellie Orr. And we're going to get to all of that. But I want to say good morning and welcome first to Diana. Diana, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me and having this conversation. I'm looking forward to it, Sandy.
Diana, you have such an interesting past. I know you went to Yale. You started writing there and had great success. And you also worked with Tony Blankley, which was a favorite of many of us.
Yes.
The British writer who died of cancer probably 8-9 years ago, maybe.
Yes.
But I'm curious to know... why your interest in Russia and all and communism and the underlying dark parts of this story?
Well, I grew up. I came to adulthood in the 1980s, and my first vote was from Ronald Reagan, and so I was very naturally oriented toward the traditional Cold War framework. I studied Soviet history when I was in college. And later on, as we witnessed the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the world seemed to change, and 9/11 happened, and I was a journalist, and I'm fast-forwarding very quickly, but essentially, I became interested in communism really again on encountering the logjam in understanding Islam, which came and attacked us on 9/11, and I was working then at the Washington Times on the editorial page. This was actually shortly before Tony Blankley came onto the page. And I noticed similarities in terms of the extreme reluctance and even suppression of the facts about Islam that suddenly reminded me and sent me back to learning about the same logjam repression reluctance to acknowledge and indeed debate, discuss, and illuminate the facts about communism. And if you go back to the Cold War and the great anti-communists of yore, you find them being vilified as red baiters, if you remember that word. Well, when we looked in the post 9/11 era, particularly, if you wanted to have a factual discussion of Islam and its relationship to terrorism, jihad, and religious repression, etc., you were castigated and marginalized as an Islamophobe. And the similarities were so striking to me that I ended up really spending about 4 years writing American Betrayal, which is kind of a re-excavation of this history and relating it to our situation today. So that's kind of the story in a nutshell.
Diana, I guess it never occurred to me, I don't know why, but we know that there was a cooperation between the Nazis and, for instance, the Muslim Brotherhood. But what was the relationship between... when communism was in its heyday, openly, in Russia and China, what was the relationship between the Islamists and the communists? Any that we know of?
Yes, I think that it's actually a very old relationship. There are great commonalities between Islam and communism that are very important to keep in mind as we watch the what's often called the red-green axis work in our political life and cultural life today. And this goes back to the basics of both creeds being collectivist, one-party rule, the individual religious liberty, freedom of expression, non-existent, all for the collective, the Ummah in Islam, and the communist collective in under communism. The similarities are such that early visitors to the Soviet Union after the Russian Revolution, going back to 1917 and the 1920s, just after, a number of them were struck by the sort of resurgence in terms of the ethos and drive of Islam within communism, in terms of its, that's what it reminded them of. And we actually see Adolf Hitler, going forward into the war period, lamenting the fact that Islam never got to Germany. In other words, in its incursions across Europe, Southern Europe, Spain, and so on, Eastern Europe, it was stopped. It was stopped at the gates of Vienna, very famously, in 1683. It did not get to Germany, and he lamented that because he thought that the Germans would be better warriors. So you see these kinds of
interesting
commonalities and sort of answering echoes in all really state-controlled totalitarian systems, and Islam, which in itself, there was a very famous Islamic expert of yore, an academic great writer, who called it doubly totalitarian because Islam controls the political, public life and legal life, also the interior life. So he actually had the phrase doubly totalitarian. So these similarities are very important to keep in mind as we watch, as we live through the this particularly aggressive cycle of both the left and Islam.
Diana, let's bring it home for our discussion, because our focus is going to be on their attempts to, meaning communism today, their attempts to infiltrate and control the United States government. I think probably a good question is, why are communists so evangelical? What is their passion, to spread themselves all across the globe? Why do they feel so compelled, and what drives them?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm probably not as well equipped to answer it. It goes to that psychological drive to control and to impose, and it is something you associate with zealots and people who are very intolerant of conscience, of religious fever, fervency of all manner of freedom and individual liberty. So it's a worldview. It's an animating worldview. And as we know from the history of the 20th century, it has been very bloody, because to impose will in this sense and to drive God out and to coerce the human spirit in this way, there has to be great bloodshed in order to impose this will. Certainly in the first century of watching communism take its hold. I would say that in order to think about it in our own terms today, I think that we have to understand that communism has had great success in infiltrating our systems, not just our government, but our cultural institutions, our educational, the academia, all of our colleges and high schools, and going down into grade school, into our religion, into our churches, into our synagogues. It has had tremendous success. So when we're looking for it today, we don't find the open party flourishing. We find Marxism flourishing. And I think that the beginning of our misunderstanding goes to the point of the Soviet Union's dissolution back in 1991. America declared victory in the Cold War. The Soviet Union, as we knew it, was gone. And yet ask yourself, why is it that on our own college campuses, our victorious nation's college campuses, there is absolute Marxist control in the sense that you cannot speak as a conservative? The Constitution is barely tolerated in terms of teaching. The free market is spurned. All manner of socialist manners and mores flourish and indeed are imposed on students coming in. I mean, so we could go on and do a whole show about this, but it is a point of understanding that what we're told and what we believe is not borne out by
Diana,
the fact of our...
Hold that thought, because we have to take a break. But when we come back, let's pick this up, because we're going to get practical here about what's happening in our headlines and what's going on that we cannot see. And that we need to be made aware of. My guest is Diana West, award-winning journalist. We'll be right back after this. Sandy Rios in the morning.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
The Senate Intelligence Committee has taken a recent interest in former Associate Attorney General Bruce Orr and his reported connections with Fusion GPS. And it is this interest that is telling, says Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton.
The fact that the Senate Intelligence Committee is bringing in Bruce Orr, this Justice Department official involved with Fusion GPS and the Clinton dossier, shows you where the collusion scandal is. It's with the Clinton campaign, the DNC, the FBI, the Justice Department. How did they use this dossier? Was Mueller using this dossier? Was it used to spy? Was it used to justify to a court to get warrants to spy on Trump and his team? These are all open questions.
And the fact that the Senate Intelligence Committee wants to interview Orr underscores that fact, and that the FBI was actually involved with the Russian dossier.
Bruce Orr is the first indication we have that the Justice Department itself was involved in this dossier that's been so controversial, the dossier created by Hillary Clinton's campaign, the Democratic National Committee. We know the FBI had a hand in it, was using it, may have paid individuals associated with it. Now we learn that Bruce Orr was also meeting with the dossier's authors. And so the question is, why?
And one clue may be Orr's wife, Nellie, who reportedly was working for Fusion GPS.
Well, it turns out the same firm that created the dossier had also hired Bruce Orr's wife. Again, Bruce Orr, senior Justice Department official, head of the Organized Crime Division, also a deputy assistant AG, so really up there in the ranks in terms of the Department of Justice. Given his senior position in the Justice Department, one would suspect he'd be involved in the Russia collusion investigations. So there are going to be questions about what his involvement was, how did he use the dossier, what was he communicating with this Clinton campaign vendor about.
John Hines, One America News.
All right, that was Tom Fitton on One America News, and that's kind of a fast forward, a quick fast forward from our discussion with Diana West, because we want to talk about what may be happening in our country now that we cannot see. And Diana, before we jump into that headline, let's just briefly touch on ways that the Soviets, the old Soviets, the KGB, under those old monikers, managed to infiltrate and influence our system in, say, the 50s and 60s. Just a word about that.
Well, I think the operational word to understand is it never stopped. The infiltration didn't stop. That really started, again, going back 100 years to the Russian Revolution. So the what you saw in the 50s and 60s is what you saw in the 30s and 40s, and it's what you saw in the 70s and 80s. And after the fall of the Soviet Union, you continue to see that, and there's any number of famous cases that were broken after we thought our Soviet adversary was gone. And these would continue right up to 2010, I believe it was, when the FBI unmasked a hardened network of Soviet operatives living undercover, known as the illegals, and they were sent home so as not to tarnish Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration. So a continuing saga.
A continuing saga and handled very differently in the various decades. You know, when we were very anti-communist in this country when I was growing up, and to watch the pivot, as you were describing right before we took the break, of what's happening on college campuses where Marxism is popular. Kids are wearing,
yes,
Che Guevara T-shirts. And,
right.
You know, it's just, it's shocking that they think that communism is superior to real capitalism, not crony. They don't even know the difference. And so we are seeing an ignorance set in, and I think it's setting in. Even the parents of children now don't know,
yes,
the distinctions. So, Diana, that takes us to today, our current times. And we now are seeing, look, it's one thing, you and I have a background and probably might see, we can't, up until recently, I don't even know that we felt free to say communism the same way we're repeating it now, because they made the word dirty. Like you were ignorant if you accused people or ideas of being communist. But that's really not off. Now we can say that with more assurance. However, you and I might see it in ways that other people don't. But now it's in the headlines. We actually have something we can trace to this ideology and what's happening in our elections, but maybe not in the way the Democrats think. Describe, if you will, this whole business of how the Russians were involved. And I've discussed this many times on the air, so this is not new territory for my listeners. But how the Russians were involved in this Fusion GPS created dossier that reported such terrible things about candidate and now President Donald Trump?
Well, it's such a fascinating story. And of course, the basic premise is that the sources of the dossier are virtually all Russian, including, according to the dossier itself, Kremlin sources, people active in Vladimir Putin's government, and also intelligence agencies. So the sourcing of the dossier is, in fact, purports to be Russian. So that is our premise in terms of understanding where this information is coming from. Now, people who are versed in how intelligence works, how Soviet intelligence, Russian intelligence works, because they're the same. The KGB didn't stop, it just changed names. Understand that any time information comes out of the Kremlin, out of Russia, with Russian official knowledge, it is no longer intelligence, it is Russian disinformation. And this is something that is basic tradecraft in terms of, in other words, if Russian officials are supervising what an American or a British agent is taking out and disseminating back to the FBI, back to our media, and so on, it is a controlled flow of operation. So that, right from the start, is a very serious strike against anything inside the dossier, even before you attempt to verify it and find, you know, separate fact from fiction, which undoubtedly will exist in any flow of disinformation. But the control factor is very important. So that would be one beginning. Another is more harder to see for this, our world, our time. And this is what I've been trying to delve into, which is looking at what we've learned since Donald Trump was elected president about the effort, I would use the word conspiracy, against him inside the government. It's not normal. It's just not the way we change political parties every 4 years or every 8 years in Washington. And the abnormality of these lengths to which these different participants have gone, which seem to break serious laws and therefore jeopardize their careers. Many of these are very highly placed senior bureaucrats who have worked very hard to climb to the top and have a lot of perks and a lot of power and a lot of pension under threat at this point for what they've done or appear to have done. It's just not the way it's done. You and I know that people, they go out of power, they come back into power, and the bureaucrats just stay. So there's something very strange here. And you asked earlier about what's driving these people in terms of communism in general. Well, I was very curious, what's driving this web? And I started looking at them more closely and trying to understand if there are indeed the familiar old communist ideological drivers, the Marxist-infused background, the experiences, the intellectual interest. And indeed, I find it very much so in the person of Nellie Orr in particular. She is the wife of Bruce Orr, whom the intro was talking about, in terms of being the Fusion GPS contractor, who was also married to the former top Justice Department official, Bruce Orr, who remains, by the way, a Justice Department official. He just lost his top job title. He's been essentially demoted. And she was also, according to the House Intelligence memo put out by the majority, she was also involved in the cultivation of sources in terms of the writing of the so-called Steele dossier. She is a Russian speaker. She has a PhD in Russian history. She got a ham radio operator's license shortly after she began working for GPS Fusion, which, again, going back to old-style tradecraft, that used to be something you would find actual spies using to communicate. It's just a fact. Maybe she's an enthusiast. I don't know. But, you know, these are the kinds of items that do flag her as a person of interest to get more information on.
Diana, can I interrupt you just for a second? Look, let me just say that Diana has written a very detailed, interesting, fascinating article on Nellie. And we're not going to get to everything. It's called Nellie Orr, Woman in the Middle. Nellie Orr, Woman in the Middle. And we will link that on our Facebook page. But in your discovery of her background, Diana, you mentioned that she studied in the USSR in 1989. Yes. And that to me is a red flag, because before 91, look, I was there in 91, in the spring when Boris Yeltsin was running for president. So that was the beginning of the breakup and the freedom. But it was not normal. People didn't go, unless it's just escaped my understanding, not a lot of Americans were studying inside the USSR before the Soviet Union broke up.
Not at all. It was a very rigidly controlled process by which American researchers, PhD candidates, and the like would have to essentially come under Soviet official censorship in order to be approved for study, in order to even enter an archive. They were selected for their subject. They were selected for their purpose. There's actually a very fascinating book written about the Soviet research experience for Americans in which Nellie Orr appears. That's the only reason we even know publicly that she had this experience studying in the Soviet Union. And the book itself actually goes through what the researchers had to put up with in terms of their proposals and indeed hewing to their proposals when they were trying to do research. So essentially, to do that kind of research, you had to agree to Soviet KGB-style dictates on what you would look at and what you would write. So that in itself is indeed a red flag, not to be too punny. I would like to also throw in that another credential of Nellie Orr's that's very troubling and needs illumination is she has a CIA credential as an analyst. In 2010, we don't know the nature of her association. We don't know if it continues. We don't know if she was on a CIA contract of any kind while she was at GPS Fusion or what, but we do know she does have this affiliation in 2010, which needs to be explained, because think of it, if we're looking at a CIA-connected person, we don't know if she's has a relationship with John Brennan, if we're looking at a CIA-related person in what we are understanding as domestic spying, this rises again, going back to the Watergate model, this rises again to these very, very serious levels of the perversion of our government and its surveillance capabilities on American citizens, on our political process. So she's a very important person to know more about.
And yet, there isn't much. Look, you've done some digging and you've pulled up some stuff we haven't gotten to yet. But in terms of public knowledge, we know so little about her, Diana. I know that the first time I saw this story break, I think I mentioned to you, she reminded me of the old movies we used to see in the 60s about the old Soviet. She reminded me of a Soviet operative. That's exactly what I thought before I knew anything about her.
Right.
I know you cannot go on appearance. Maybe could I please add that? But she certainly,
yes.
She looks like like she was perfectly cast into the role of some Soviet spy. That doesn't mean anything, but it just is interesting because
right.
Then you actually pulled out some of her writings. And what did you find about, you know, anything to affirm our suspicion here?
Well, in terms of ideological orientation, absolutely, and quite strongly. This is nothing, no intimation of anything. This is what she's written. Her field of expertise, she has a Harvard degree and a Stanford PhD in Russian history, Soviet history. Her degree area of focus was the 1930s, the aftermath of the catastrophic collectivization that Stalin perpetrated against the people of Ukraine primarily, whereby private farming was seized by the government, and millions and millions and millions of people died of state-enforced starvation, deportation, and other harms and violence and matters. And the number is as high as 14 million, according to Robert Conquest figures. A number of people agree on 6 million. I mean, at a certain point of million, it's hard to see things as worse, really. The human catastrophe was so strong. Her PhD thesis was called The Stabilization of the Collective Farm Order. So she's looking at the aftermath here, which to me suggests a sense of coming to terms with this human deprivation, depredations, which she actually discusses as excesses. Excesses. This is a word that she uses to describe this. Getting more specific, the school of history that she follows, it's very clear, a revisionist school whereby the human toll is minimized or understood or rationalized for what she actually calls, quote, the agonizing paradoxes of the Stalin era, which, of course, tells us that with the bad, oh, terrible killing and so on, and lack of freedom, etc., oh, but there were good things as well. So this is kind of her mindset in terms of looking at this just human waste period of just utter, you know, crimes against humanity created by the communist dictatorship. So she is someone who regards them with a degree of sympathy, even though, of course, I'm not saying she denies these activities and events took place. But there is this sense of rationalization that is very much a hallmark of this revisionist school, which I will point out was essentially founded by a number of the early revisionists in the 1970s.
Diana, hold that thought. Hold that thought. Who were Marxists?
Alrighty.
She said, in case you missed that. Diana West is my guest. The article is called Nellie Orr, Woman in the Middle. And, of course, we're hearing that she may have, in fact, it's possible that she actually might have been the author of the dossier. And we'll talk about that when we come back. Plus, we want to explore a little bit the relationship between Mrs. Clinton and the Russians and President Obama and the Russians. Stay tuned. My guest is Diana West, Sandy Rios, in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
New disclosures confirmed to Fox News by top investigators on the House Intelligence Committee show that the link between Fusion GPS, the firm behind that anti-Trump dossier, and a top Justice Department official ran deeper than previously known. Fox News was the first to tell you last week about the abrupt demotion on Wednesday of Bruce Orr, the Associate Deputy Attorney General, who was stripped of that title and his fourth floor office at Maine Justice amid an ongoing investigation into his contacts with the two leading figures in the controversy over the dossier, meetings that DOJ officials told Fox News Orr had withheld from his superiors. House Intelligence Committee staff uncovered that Orr met last year with both Christopher Steele, the former British spy who authored the dossier with input from Russian sources, and that Orr also met last year with Glenn Simpson, the founder of Fusion GPS, the opposition research firm that paid Mr. Steele with funding from the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee. Now Fox News has confirmed that Nellie Orr, an academic Russia expert and the wife of Bruce Orr, worked for Fusion GPS last year. Indeed, was paid by the opposition research firm through the summer and fall of 2016, a timeline that places her on the company payroll around the time the dossier was funneled to the FBI, and perhaps up through the election, some 2 weeks after which her husband met secretly with Glenn Simpson. The House Intelligence Committee Chairman Nunes told Fox News in a statement today is looking into all facets of the connections between the Department of Justice and Fusion GPS, including Mr. Orr, unquote. DOJ, which initially claimed that Bruce Orr had been stripped of his top-line duties because he was holding down two jobs at DOJ, and that was, quote, unusual, today had no comment about the revelation that Mrs. Orr worked for Fusion GPS last year.
You know, and as Diana just told you before we took the break, that's not a new report by James Rosen. That's probably been a month, I'm guessing, a month ago. And so Bruce Orr is still at the Justice Department. Rod Rosenstein, of course, is overseeing the Russian investigation. So thank you to Assistant Attorney General Rod Rosenstein acting on the Russian scandal situation. He's still there. It's an amazing story. Nellie Orr has been exposed now. That's what we're discussing. Diana's article really gives her story in great depth. You've heard the name Christopher Steele over and over again. We're told that he was a British spy based in Russia. But what you might not have connected is that he was expelled from Russia, something like he hasn't even been there in 20 years. And yet, allegedly, because he had credibility, he has given credit for writing this dossier. Diana, I would love to know your thoughts about Christopher Steele and who actually wrote this.
Yes, well, I think it's important to understand that, of course, having spent 20 years or thereabouts working for British intelligence, there's not very much public information about Christopher Steele. But when we go back to his time at Cambridge, we do have some clues. We understand that he was very much a hard-left college student. One quotation in a Daily Mail story called him a avowedly left-wing, I believe, with CND credentials. That CND was the very famous British Nuclear Freeze organization that was infiltrated by Marxists. This is something that's part of the record. He also is described as an avowed socialist in a history of the very famous Cambridge Union Debating Society that was written in recent years by someone who is now a advisor to Theresa May, also a Cantabrugian. So we're looking at someone who certainly comes out of a similar background to Nellie Orr, with his intelligence experience in Britain, almost looks like her opposite number, as they used to say in espionage novels, in terms of she has the CIA credential, he has the MI6 career. So these are things to keep in mind about Christopher Steele that are very rarely discussed going forward. Some people say that he essentially put his name, or his name went onto the dossier as a means of somehow elevating it. Others do seem, and this Senator Graham seems to think, that Nellie Orr was very instrumental in the writing of the dossier. The House memo discusses her in terms of cultivation of sources with her Russian language fluency, her connections, etc. This may in fact be true. These are things that need to come out. We still don't know. I will add that there is another Fusion GPS contractor whose name is Edward Baumgartner, whom I discovered was actually a Russian history major at Vassar at the time Nellie Orr was a professor there in the mid-1990s. So is he a protege of Nellie Orr's, also working the Russia team for GPS Fusion? He is believed to be the on-the-ground Russian, on-the-ground in Russia employee. So we don't know enough yet, but we have a lot to look at here.
So, Diana, from the left's perspective, of course, they say that the Russians hacked the DNC email. Let me just drop in, without us getting too sidetracked, that if the Russians had done that, they could have hidden that. Could they not? I mean, they would not be allowing this to be known. They would have hidden it much more craftily. We also know that the FBI did not even go into the DNC server. They allowed a contractor to go in and just took their word for it.
Right.
So let's talk about Mueller. Let's just jump to that. Robert Mueller was the FBI director for a long time, right after 9/11, up until a few years ago when James Comey took his place. What interactions do we know about with Robert Mueller and the Russians?
Well, I think the most interesting one that's relevant to today is that he was FBI director when that ring of Russian agents, those hardened, alias, illegal Russian agents, were rolled up. It was an operation called Ghost Stories. It was a 10-year surveillance operation by the FBI, one of their most successful counterintelligence operations ever. And when they were rolled up, it turns out it was because that members of this Russian ring were getting too close to a sitting cabinet official who is known to be Hillary Clinton. And what did Robert Mueller, FBI director, do? Well, he presided over the instant deportation of this Russian ring before the customary time had gone by to debrief them, to perhaps effect a better trade, perhaps to turn them and send them back working for us. All these very typical things that happen in these situations over the past generations did not happen, because this might have harmed the Obama administration, and particularly Hillary Clinton. It's a political calculation. It had nothing to do with our national security. None of these things were done to ensure our national security. And I think when we look, for example, at the recent indictment by Robert Mueller of another group of Russians in Russia for crimes against our election in terms of, quote, trolling or internet activities and so on, with no hope of prosecution, I think we have to understand it as the mirror image of when he allowed those Russians to go home without any protest, without coming to the American people and talking about Russian influence on our elections, on our political system. Now he talks about Russian influence on our political system in order to incriminate President Trump. In the past, he did not talk about Russian influence on the political system in order to protect Hillary Clinton and President Obama.
Very clearly stated.
That's a very strong case to be made, that he's
too.
Not acting out of national security. He's serving political masters.
I think you're absolutely right. And Diana, we cannot run out of time before I ask you to address the notion that Vladimir Putin wanted Donald Trump to be president. Talk about that. please.
Yes, I think that that is one of the great big lies of our time. I've been thinking about it and thinking about it, and I'll just leave you with this in order to even think about it for yourself. Hillary Clinton, as Barack Obama's successor, would have presided over the continuing military decline of the United States. Indeed, on the campaign trail, she even said things like she saw no need to update our nuclear cruise missile. There was not a she couldn't think of a reason in the world to do so. When you compare that to Donald Trump, who came on the political scene, vowing to restore and expand our nuclear arsenal in particular, along with restoring our defense posture in general, but particularly talking about nuclear weaponry, there is no way that a good strategic thinker inside the Kremlin would prefer to see that person take office and indeed restore American nuclear superiority, which in many fields we have lost. We saw just a couple of days ago Vladimir Putin unveiling his hypersonic cruise missiles. Well, we go back to the Obama-Clinton years and we see hypersonic missile technology developing as a part of the Russian reset in a place called Skolkovo, which is a high-tech center outside Moscow that was very much a part of the Obama-Clinton Russian reset. So these are things to consider when you actually imagine, if you were sitting in the Kremlin, who you would prefer, someone who's going to restore American prowess, particularly nuclear, or someone who will continue to break it down. And I think that that is the place to start thinking about the question about really who liked whom. And also when we throw the dossier in, I think that that is where we see our intelligence officials saying that they had it on good intelligence that Vladimir Putin hated Hillary Clinton. It comes right out of the dossier, and we've been talking about what we think of that. So these are things to really keep in mind because the narrative is not the fact.
And I think, you know, just to clarify, Diana, it's not a hard thing to imagine that Vladimir Putin probably enjoys President Trump more than he would enjoy on a human level and respect. I think he probably respects Donald Trump, does not respect Hillary Clinton, but that would not inform his choice. He's going to be constantly thinking about what's best for Russia and their purposes. And I think it's clear that Mrs. Clinton would have been better for them. We could just talk, you know, I have discussed here often the collusion, real collusion between the Clintons and the Russians. This is the astounding story of the Uranium One scandal and the millions of hundreds of thousands of dollars that Bill Clinton got for speaking fees and all of that. But in our remaining minutes, what I have not really spoken as clearly about lately is the connection between Barack Obama and the Russians. Could you just talk about that for a second?
Yes. Well, I think that this becomes, you know, it's part of a continuum. But when we go back to the, you can go back a long way with Barack Obama in terms of his own upbringing and grooming for the presidency included mentoring by hardened communist operatives. That would be Frank Marshall Davis, his mentor as a young man, who was actually on the FBI arrest list in the event of a war with the Soviet Union going back in the day. And then you look at his very close aides, particularly in the first term with David Axelrod, another scion of the American Communist Networks. The Cantor family were mentors of his, and Valerie Jarrett, whose own family history, you can read the family FBI files at Judicial Watch. Her forebears were very involved in the entire communist apparatus in this country. Very important tells in terms of ideological orientation. And I would say that with the Clintons almost bookending him, we dodged the bullet on Mrs. Clinton. But when we go back and we look at Bill Clinton, you can call the father of the Chinese MIRV missile. You really can. When we go back to that history of the 90s and the outflow of sensitive military technology in exchange for campaign cash from China, from the Chinese military in the 1990s, when we look at Mrs. Clinton and the Obama administration, we can say that Hillary Clinton may well be the mother of the Russian hypersonic nuclear cruise missile. This is a continuum, and it is absolutely shocking that the deflection campaign to throw and project all of this on the nascent Trump campaign and early Trump presidency so that we don't look back and actually understand what's really in front of us is one of the great sleights of hand if it works and scandals if it doesn't. We've got to get our grip on this and understand what is really going on as opposed to what we're told is going on, because all the signs are there. It's really not that hard, but we're sort of paralyzed in so many ways by what we hear and how we're told to look at these things, that we just have to get back and look at what is really going on. And I think that the hypersonic missile is something we really need to remember, because it's a threat today, along with the Chinese MIRV missile. So these are very important ongoing relationship with the communist world that we've seen in these particular Democratic presidents and presidential candidates.
Before we run out of time, Diana has I don't know if you call it a blog or your website. It's DianaWest.net. DianaWest.net. She writes about this stuff. We have just scratched the surface of her knowledge of the infiltration and influence of communism on the world, and especially in this country. And so I encourage you to go to DianaWest.net, and also we'll put her most current article on Nelly or on our Facebook page so that you can read and share it. But Diana, you're a national treasure. Thank you for your great writing and your great research. Thank you.
Oh, that's very kind, Sandy. Thank you.
Okay, talk to you soon. All right, well, there you go. Another light topic and a day with Sandy Rios. But I hope it's expanding your knowledge base. I want you to be wise and smart when you hear the news, and to have a better understanding of what's going on in this world. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.